Okay, hello everyone. I'm Ariella Cole O'Reilly and this is Tim Peterson. We're both researchers at WashU and we're here representing VitaDAO, which is a decentralized organization and community devoted to funding aging research. And we are so pleased today to have Dr. Luigi Ferrucci here with us, and he's the scientific director of the National Institute on Aging at the NIH. He's a geriatrician, an epidemiologist, and truly a pioneer of aging research. So we are so excited to have you here. How are you?
I'm good. Hi, Ariella. Hi, team. Hi. Very nice being with you this morning.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much. All right, Tim, you want to get started with our questions?
Yeah, so we're just going to jump right into it here. So just kind of the basic question, you know, we have kind of a mixed audience here. So we wanted to just start with some of the basics here. So from your view, why is it important to fund research on aging?
Well, that's a basic question that, you know, may take the entire hour to really go through it, but I'll try to be brief. So historically, the study of aging has been a curiosity. You know, as we age, there are cultural, anthropological aspect of it. We want to know about, but aging is occurring. So that there was a little bit of the Cinderella of science, okay? That is in between medical, physiological, cultural, environmental, aspect. And that is because, as my predecessor were saying, aging cannot be changed. Aging is a natural process. And so because cannot be changed, what Nathan Schock wanted to do in funding the Baltimore Longitudinal Study of Aging was to dissociate aging from disease. So we would not attribute to disease the effect of aging. What really changed is that we are starting to realize that, first of all, aging actually can be modulated, and that experiment in the animal model, the initial gene mutation in C. elegans and in mice, and then also the intervention, calorie restriction, and many other pharmacological intervention now that are supposed to really slow down the effect of aging and increase longevity in this model, show that it can be modulated, first. And second, we now realize that when we look in depth at the process of disease, we find underneath the mechanism of aging. And so aging seems to be pervasively affecting multiple chronic disease. And so from the Cinderella of science, now, aging become the main, most important factor that we need to understand and control if we want to improve the health at the population level. It's really the, throwing wave of what we need to do to obtain, better, outcome. And before I finish, because I think I'm very, very much interested in molecules, but I'm much more interested in people. Mm-hmm. Think about the fact that we're making incredible progress in the cure of cardiovascular disease. We're making incredible progress, especially with the new, lymphocyte treatment of immunological treatment of cancer, really has opened a window of opportunity that is tremendous. We are not making a dent in our treatment of people with complex multimorbidity. We are absolutely obtaining no success. And unless we understand the mechanism of aging, we will not improve in that direction, which is the bulk of what medical care is actually facing nowadays.
So I heard you mention multimorbidity. Do you think you could, define that for our audience and talk a tiny bit about that?
Well, multimorbidity is the most frequent disease that people have. You clearly say that what is the prevalence of cardiovascular disease, what is the prevalence of cancer, what is the prevalence of pulmonary disease. So if you look at people above the age of 65, the highest prevalent disease is having two diseases or more. So it's when you have at the same time multiple diseases. And it's very important to recognize that because our medical field is based on a one disease model. You know, mm-hmm. I am a physician. I study on internal medicine and surgery. And, you know, each chapter is like isolated by a wall from the other. When you really talk about the heart, you're not talking about the other organs. And it doesn't work that way. Humans and animals are, you know, essentially complex organisms, all interconnected. So multimorbidity represents the clinical manifestation of the increased susceptibility to trauma and stress that occur with aging. And so it's really a proxy measure of the rate of age or the pace of aging.
And so maybe some more kind of definitional things. So you mentioned multimorbidity, so kind of the combination of diseases. So I think you threw it in there too, that, you know, that aging is kind of the number one risk factor for many diseases. Maybe can you've spoke in the past about how kind of aging used to be a confounder when doing research. Maybe you can kind of talk about the shift on how focusing on age as a variable, how that allowed us to see that, you know, that it was not a confounder, but actually, you know, the major driver of aging. So
yeah, I mean, I would reconnect this answer to what I said at the beginning.
Yeah.
No, I think that the epidemiology and most of the medical statistics derive from the study of cancer and cardiovascular disease, you know, where you have a risk factor, and the risk factor is associated at some point with the development of an outcome. Myocardial infarction, cancer, you know, the statistic has been sophisticated tremendously, but the paradigm is still, you know, the independent variable and the dependent variable, many, many variations around it. And so when you have that paradigm in mind, everything that you cannot change becomes a confounder, because you don't need to know about it, because it's unavoidable. It cannot be changed. And so you adjust for age, and you learn that adjusting for age or sex, or breaking your analysis by age and sex, is the paradigm that you have to implement in every analysis. Unless at some point, as I mentioned already before, you start thinking that maybe aging is modifiable. And then it may not be a confounder, it becomes a risk factor. And if it is a factor, it's in the causal pathway. And if it is in the causal pathway, that can no longer be a confounder. And so that is the paradigm shift. It's where the geroscience hypothesis is truly going.
Yeah, that's an excellent answer. And I'm glad you brought up the geroscience hypothesis. Do you want to define that quickly for our audience?
I think that we already done it here. You know, mm-hmm. The idea that the biological mechanisms of aging are those that drive most of the phenotypic and functional manifestation that we have learned to recognize as the aging process. You know, the wrinkling of the skin, you know, the reduction in muscle strength, but also the increased risk of heart disease, the increase of pulmonary disease, the reduction in, you know, working capacity, you know, many, many of the aspects that I schematically always represent in three levels, and the thinking in three levels, it's truly helpful in interpreting aging, you know, biological mechanisms, phenotypic manifestation, and functional consequence. If you think that way, you really need to link them to understand aging, and only aging only exists in the context of three levels of measure, not only in one of them. It's a little bit like, you know, quantum mechanics, where you can only observe an event, you know, in the context of everything that is around it. That's the same for aging.
Right. So now that we've established how important it is to fund aging research, can you tell us what you think are some of the main challenges that come up in trying to fund aging research as opposed to research on, say, cancer or another specific disease?
So first of all, I want to be optimistic. I think that there are very clear signs that it's becoming progressively less of a problem. because many, many, you know, foundation companies and even, you know, medical institutions are starting to recognize that aging is something that is worth studying because may have, you know, the strongest impact on the health of our population. But still problem exists. And the most important issue is, like, historically, you always have a time discrepancy between the cultural shift and the societal organization that does not adapt quickly enough to that cultural shift. I think that there was a very, you know, smart historian, Petronio, that really interpret history in this level, where the overstructure, that is the cultural change, it's faster than what's happening in the society. And so this discrepancy generates a lot of friction. I'll give you an example. You know, we recognize that we need to have an impact on aging, but if you talk to the FDA, aging is not a disease. And because it's not a disease, it's not an indication that can be used to propose a clinical trial of an intervention that will affect the pace of aging. And you know, things are changing there as well. I think that there are some people in the FDA that think that, you know, we should be a little bit more flexible in interpretation of this definition, but it's a process. You know, we will get there because the reality, you know, the cultural shift eventually will, you know, meet with the change at the societal level. And so we will do that. It's time.
You know, I'm glad that you brought up the FDA not viewing aging as an indication, you know, for trials of novel therapeutics. Do you have any prediction of when they might flip that decision? And
look, it's going to happen. You know, the I don't have a crystal ball, so I can't really tell you whether it's tomorrow, in 3 years, or in 10 years. But it's going to happen. I think that there are openings. And I think that Neil Barzilai had been, you know, by suggesting the TAME trial, have discussed it with the FDA. They did not allow, you know, us to use the aging as an indication, but they use multimorbidity, which really, you know, is the same thing. You know, if aging is the driving force in the accumulation of disease because it represents the origin of susceptibility to the disease, then slowing down the accumulation of multiple disease is equivalent to slowing down the pace of aging, or at least slowing down the pace of aging that we're interested in. You know, you may not want to call it aging, but it's resulting to, you know, slower accumulation of disease. It's okay for me. We may not want to call it aging. I think that, you know, with this continuous adjustment, we just need a strong hit. We need the success. We need the trial that show that this approach works. And when we can demonstrate that this approach works, you know, people will change their idea and things will be different.
So maybe just some definition of things. So the TAME trial is this metformin trial by Dr.
Yes,
Barzilai.
Yes, sorry.
Yeah. And then there's also the PEARL trial that's involving rapamycin. So there's a few trials that were the community is trying to get out there in the wild.
I made the assumption,
So it's good you bring up those trials. You know, so those are trials, right, with aging as the indication, but we're sort of allowed to get away with that because they're not novel therapeutics, right? They're repurposed drugs. You know, metformin is a diabetes drug and rapamycin is already approved as an immunosuppressant. So, you know, that's not quite the change that we're all waiting for with the FDA. But do you think, you know, if those trials are a success, do you think that'll be a good driving force to make that change happen?
Well, you know, first of all, those trials are already a success before starting, because they started a discussion that is long to come. So that changing the mind of people and proposing interventions that are global and not on a specific disease has already changed the mind of many. And of course, if this trial are successful, that will open the door to even more opening, to even more flexibility. As I mentioned before, we need a hit. We need something that we can say, you see, we told you that if we were approaching aging as a therapeutic target, things will work and that we will have strong effect. I think that's the reality, there are many things that, well, first of all, I wanted to study aging when I was 15, and I'm still doing it. I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but many, many years later. And I think that still think that is a little bit early. We are going faster than we can. I'll explain to you what I want to say. We still think that we want to slow down aging, but we don't know how to measure aging. We don't really have a good biomarker or a good definition of what the pace of aging is. Yeah, we are approximating some, indexes, the epigenetic clock, the proteomic clocks. I participated in many, many of those science, but those are capturing a small percentage of what aging is. And we know that work in some situation and do not work in other. We refine them, we create multiple, version of them to use in different situations, but that telling you that we are, lingering around the problem and not addressing it. So unless we can find those, a good biomarker of biological aging on functional aging, we will not be able to fully implement the behavioral science hypothesis. The second issue is that even if we believe that the hallmark of aging are the culprit of what we want to address to slow down aging, they're still very theoretical and are still very in animal model. I've been struggling for the last 5 years to implement some of those hallmarks of aging measures in the Baltimore Longitudinal Study of Aging and in other studies. And still very, very partial. You want to study autophagy, beautiful idea, but how do you study it? Do you study that in lymphocytes? Do you study that in the skin? Do you study that in the heart? And why when you publish a paper, you can be happy with one of those tissues? I think that when you want to use it to understand aging in an organism, you need to understand how, whether measuring it in one tissue is representative of what is happening in the entire body. We don't know. Even the best one that we have good measure for, mitochondria, I think there is a very good, there's some evidence that there's a synchrony in the aging of mitochondria across different tissues. And so that when you study mitochondria in the muscle, which is the most accessible tissue, may not be indicative of what's happening to mitochondria in the brain and what is happening to mitochondria in the liver. So we have a fundamental technological, impasse that we need to overcome. We will get there. There's a lot of smart people that are working on it. And so I think it's going to happen. But these two, stones need to be, addressed if we really want to do the work on aging at the clinical level.
So I wanted to kind of get maybe more in a meta conversation. So you mentioned Cinderella science, the study of aging was kind of seen as evasive and had some kind of perception issues perhaps. So how can we do a better job in our community with messaging and terminology? There's kind of amongst the kind of people who consider themselves serious researchers, words like anti-aging is kind of off limits, right? And we use at Vita Dao, we use the word longevity, but that's also not something that's, particularly a mainstream, at least in academic culture. So Maybe you just can speak a little bit to the, you know.
Well, I can try. I think that, you know, the premise is that I spend many, many hours of my life discussing what is the best definition of frailty. And we never got anywhere because that's not the problem. Finding the word is not really the problem. It's understanding how to treat it. So having said that, that the definition are useful to a certain extent, but don't solve the problem. I think that I love the idea that we talk about health span, because I think that really longevity means that extreme longevity, and I'm not really sure that this is something that is mentally the desire of the population around us. You know, I learn most of what I do from my patient, you know, in another life when I was still a good doctor. And if you talk to them, many are afraid of losing independence. Many are afraid that there will be a weight on their children. They are afraid that what they love to do, you know, kind of reading poetry or walking on the beach or, you know, painting or doing the thing that they like to do, well, they will not be able to do that anymore. Not very many, I heard, are afraid of dying. So I think that if we want to have an expanded view of what improving aging means, to me, is improving health span. Health is not everything, you know, because otherwise I'm going to fight with the people that tell me that you can be extremely happy even if you have 10 diseases. That is absolutely true, but it's much less likely that you will be a happy person in late life if you are disabled with 10 different diseases that you're taking 15 drugs. It's not impossible. There are people that are extraordinarily talented and are able to do that. It's much less likely.
Thanks. So health span is just kind of the the years of your life kind of free from chronic diseases. So, kind of a tangential thing about getting, you know, terminology and message right, you know, in our world, you know, there's kind of two components, right? We have to publish our work and we have to fund our work. And both those things are about kind of communicating the methods of the advances in the research. I don't know if you had any thoughts on, you know, there's talks like this Plan U where, you know, there'd be a mandate for funding agencies to have the research be publicly available on preprint servers such as BioArchive. I didn't know if you had any thoughts on how publishing and funding could work together better to basically help with the messaging or just to help and bridge those two worlds together in the first place.
I think that this is not only in the field of aging. I think that, you know, scientists have a responsibility for communication that most of the time they do not fulfill. You know, they go in their meetings, they talk the talk of, you know, very sophisticated language that is inaccessible to the many. You know, I get mad. I think I am a sophisticated scientist. And when I go to a meeting and somebody talk and I can't really understand what they're talking about, I think there is something fundamentally wrong in that. Because a good scientist should be able to, you know, explain what they're doing to the most. And should also take the responsibility to explain to the public what they're doing, what is the importance of what they're doing, what is the long end purpose of what they're doing. I mean, when I talk to my student or to the people that work with me, I always tell them, you can work on a fraction of a molecule, you know, a transcript that is not even an entire gene. But you have to have in yourself the feeling that understanding that little fraction of the molecule one day will improve the quality of life of the old person that is walking around the street. And if you don't have that sense, I think being a researcher is not worthwhile. So I think that communication is important that way. Now, you talk about funding and yeah, I think funding is extremely important. I completely agree with you. I think that I don't have the magic solution for you to, expand the funding on aging. But what I think is, since when I was, in geriatric specialty, my professor, Francesco Maria Antonini, that was a very smart person, told me that it's very unlikely that we will implement geriatry for all of those that need geriatrics. But what we can do is to show to the specialties that understanding aging is very important for the work that they're doing. So I think that we need to go to the different societies and show them that when they do their work on the heart, if they consider aging, they can understand more. If you work with the physiologists that do their measure in mice that in general are between 2 and 10 years of age, 10 months of age, and they pretend to be studying aging, we should show them that the mortality curve in mice start to have any movement after the 10 months of age, and that physiology is explored across the lifespan. And then if we go to human, we can show that we have a strong connection with pediatrics that you will not believe, but the Barker hypothesis, the work of Diana Koo, the work of the people that are doing life course epidemiology show that the trajectory of aging really are rooted in what's happening in utero in the first few years of life. And so a geriatric, a gerontological intervention should be done at the age of 0 or at the age of 1. It could be extremely impactful. So by joining forces, we will also encourage more investment in aging that may not come to the Aging Institute, but will go to research on aging, which is really the purpose. I think that's the idea.
Thank you.
So on the subject of communication, I've heard you speak a lot about the importance of interdisciplinary collaboration and bringing people together from diverse backgrounds. And, our community at VitaDAO is all about that. That's really our ethos, bringing together people from a variety of different backgrounds, scientists and non-scientists, all kinds of people from all kinds of countries, and coming together to unite around this common goal. And I was wondering if you feel like, what your feelings are on the importance of interdisciplinary collaboration at the NIA and beyond, and what can be done to unite researchers who are studying separate diseases, like you mentioned, maybe a researcher studying heart disease, and to realize that that is also studying aging, and unite those fields together to study aging as the common factor.
So I feel that I'm very lucky. I live in an environment where, collaboration is, our first order of business, that I contributed to make this happening by dedicating part of our budget to collaborative work. There's a part, something around 5% of our budget that is distributed only to projects that have at least 3 labs that collaborate and where they demonstrate that this project is only possible because of the synergy between different type of expertise. That's the reality, is that there's no science if it's not team science nowadays. Because you cannot know everything. In my group, in my research group, there is somebody who's doing, proteomic analysis, not mass spectrometer, so the analysis of the proteome that come from the mass spectrometer. And that is a science that, I appreciate because I see the results, but I will never be able to do this by myself because it's just require a person to be completely dedicated. So having the synergy between the different expertise is what is getting the best result. I remember reading about NIH, the old days where there was one scientist that was telling people what to do and discovery will come up. There were different times, you know, I remember that, you know, the bottle of whiskey on the bottom drawer in the very late evening doing, you know, pictures of doing a drawing on a piece of paper. I don't think that's happening anymore. The technology made us so specialized that unless we coalesce in a research group and we communicate more, it's not going to happen. This is within NIA is happening. I think that NIH is trying to do the same. I think that, you know, while the institute are very, very organ focused, the new initiative, you know, the Neuroscience Center, for example, and the new Common Fund initiative really try to bring people together and you know, have research groups that are working around one single problem. Outside NIH is difficult, and I'll tell you why it is difficult, at least from my perspective. Well, the grant mechanism is really, you know, working on competition, and competition, you know, kind of offset, you know, collaboration. That's the first problem. And there is a second, even more important problem, is career. You know, if you collaborate with somebody to a fantastic project, but you're not first or last name in the paper, you consider that that's really not your production. And so when you go to your promotion committee, they count the paper where you are first and last. And that, and nobody think about, is this person being collaborative? Is this contribution being fundamental for the discovery that has been done by this group? There's an element that are not considered still, even at NIH, you know, starting to be considered. Again, I'll tell you that changing the structure, why the culture is, it's not a synchronous, you know, event. It will take more time for the two to get together. And hopefully it will happen, but it's not there yet.
That's a great, great thing to point out. Definitely this kind of tension between collaborating and competition. We all want to collaborate, but at the end of the day, yeah, we all have to kind of survive for ourselves. So I think I appreciate you making that effort there. So kind of a next topic is, you know, how can we kind of focus, you know, I know the NIH is on basic research and is not concerned about, you know, the things the FDA are concerned about, you know, kind of translating it to the actual clinic. But, you know, there are programs within the NIH, namely the SBIR and STTR programs, which are helping academics translate their findings to the clinic. So just kind of in general, so those are programs where you can get money to kind of start a startup company and work with universities and kind of start the process of getting your drugs into the clinic. Can maybe just in general, can you speak to how we can facilitate translational research within the NIH and in general within the aging community?
Okay, let me put this. Let me make some clarity. I will disagree with you that NIH is all interested in mechanism. I think that it may have been true. You know, I remember when I came to NIH, people told me, you are an epidemiologist. NIH is all interested in something that is smaller than a protein. If something is bigger than a protein, you're no room here. It's absolutely not true. There is an enormous amount of initiative that go from the single, more puntiform information to the application of the science in the society and the effect that science in the society can have. And I have illustrious and really smart colleagues that work in this area. So I think NIH has been able to transform itself in this direction. But the way, the argument that you're touching is more, you know, how do we go, how do we connect academia to industry? How do we, create opportunity for commercial enterprise? And I think that we could probably do something better. I mean, there are some programs that are funding, initial project or, you know, just forming groups that want to implement a specific idea. There are This is really not my expertise, but I know that they're there. We are now experimenting some small program that, you know, allow our fellow to experience during their fellowship what would be working in industry, what would be being an entrepreneur, what would be needed for you to success in this competitive world job. But certainly it's a very small part of our work. One thing that I want to say is that, and that we need to overcome, is certainly that, you know, I think that the coming of Francis Collins to NIH have changed a little bit this, because he has been very much interested, and in particular during COVID-19, to really leverage on collaboration between industry and NIH. And I think that the development of the vaccine is a paradigm success of this quintessential direction that may be better, may be done better than, but it is happening. And for example, we just created this Center for Alzheimer's Disease and Related Dementia card at NIH. And in the mission statement that we developed with the current director and the signatory with my director, Richard Hodes, was that we will try to find ways for intramural, extramural, and the industry to collaborate together on project, each one of them contributing through their specificity and find ways. That means that the intent is there. We need just to develop the tool for that to happen. And that will create opportunity for, you know, newcomers from, you know, small business that is developed around science. And I think that that certainly would be a good direction to go.
And then maybe one last thing, which is maybe more a little more of a comment than a question. So, I mean, a large issue with the academic industry, right, is this kind of issue of conflict of interest. Of course, you want the science to prevail. And of course, academics don't want to be, you know, they want the science to prevail, and they don't want the, you know, the perception that the research is being engineered in any particular direction. So I think just in my own personal experience, I think there's not a lot of education around that within academic and industry collaboration. So I think the extent to which the NIH can facilitate helping researchers at universities to be aware of how to manage the conflict of interest, you know, that's came up, of course, with COVID-19 in a lot of projects, and it's just in general a major issue. So in making sure that the work is, you know, is has integrity, is like, and like I said, it's not engineered to have any specific outcome. I mean, one simple way it seems like is just to have an independent review panel who is ensuring the integrity of the work. And so there's no kind of engineering that can be happening between the two parties. But I don't know if you have any thoughts on managing.
It's a very, very delicate discussion. I think that as in coupled, you know, it's very difficult to recognize in a fight who is, you know, guilty and who is not guilty. You know, there's always some problem on both sides. I think that, you know, we have to recognize that many of the strong success that industry have accomplished, you know, are really rooted on the basic science that was produced by NIH and funded by the people. The government is the people. And so that when they prize the fact that they developed a fantastic treatment, you know, the fact that the development of the foundation for those treatment was funded by the public is usually hidden. I think that there is a tension there, and resolving this tension would be extremely important. And on the other hand, you're right. You want to have independent creativity and not somebody, you know, looking on your shoulder of what you should do or not do. It's a process. I hope that it will happen.
All right, so thank you. Those are amazing answers to those questions. I'd like to shift gears a little bit and zoom in on some specific diagnostics and therapeutics in our field. So I heard you talk a lot about the importance of biomarkers earlier, and you also mentioned epigenetic clocks. And I've heard you speak in other interviews about how you feel epigenetic clocks, you know, such as like phenoage and grim age, are very close to clinical translation. And I was just wondering if you could elaborate on that. Like, how do you think they will actually be incorporated into the clinic?
I will start by saying that Horvath and Annum did in developing the first epigenetic clock was extraordinary. I think that, the idea that, there is a drop of blood in the corridor, you can get that drop of blood and know what is the age of the person who lost that drop of blood, to tell you something that to me is amazing. We did not have that. So there is a new chapter, from that moment, for the publication of that paper, that we are really exploring. Having said that, if I want to know the age of a person, I will use an atomic clock that would be perfect to the, infinitesimal portion of a fraction of a second. And I don't really need the epigenetic clock. But that tells you that there are processes that occur with time that are stereotyped and reproducible, which means that they represent an underlying process occur with time. And so instead of tuning them to, age or chronological age, the jump has been tuning them on health outcome, on other, gold standard. And remember, when we discussed that, I always go back to the idea that we need to distinguish aging in three levels, the biology of aging, the phenotypic manifestation of aging, and the functional manifestation of aging. This classification here, it's really important, because to me, the ideal clock is the clock that predicts the change that occur at the phenotypic and at the functional level. So your tuning should not be what you want to avoid, which is the chronological age, but should be the transformation of the body and the physiology and the function that occur with aging. First of all, that's the first problem. There is a second absolutely important problem that need to be overcome to make progress in this world. When you have decided that somebody is older biologically than expected chronologically, you make a statement that is based mostly on cross-sectional data, with the exception of the Belsky clock. All the other have been created from cross-sectional data. So when you say that this person is older, you don't know whether this person could have been older to start with. They could have been born older, and you see them at 70 and they're older. Or it may be that they were having the normal pace of aging at birth, but then the pace during life will have increased, linearly or non-linearly, or a combination of both. And imagine how different are those three scenarios. Are we measuring something that has occurred many, many, many years before and reflecting in what you have now? Are you measuring a speed of aging that evolved over time? Are you measuring somebody that had the normal speed of aging and then something happened in their physiology and biology that, speeded up, the pace of aging? I think that the new generation of clocks will have to be based on longitudinal data, will have to be based possibly on life course data. It's difficult, I know, but I think that it would be a long discussion, but it's not impossible. But I think that that would be extremely important, because then it will tell us, what are the underneath causes. And that is the last problem. You know, as predictive biomarkers, you know, the clocks, and I'm not talking only of the epigenetic clock, but there are clocks now that are proteomic clocks that are really powerful. There are lipidomic clocks that are less powerful. There are, you know, the transcriptomic clock, I still don't think they're there yet, and there are reasons for that. You know, those, we don't know where they come from. We don't know the cause of them. And unless we can recognize the cause of them, again, they become less useful as a tool to drive intervention, although they're still a very good tool for predictive validity.
So do you feel that the primary use case for these clocks is to identify targets for therapeutics, or do you think that the primary use of them will be in diagnostics?
Well, currently is in diagnostic. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody's older, that means that something is happening, need more attention, mm-hmm. or you want to do an intervention that address longevity, but you can't really wait 50 years to see whether the intervention is effective or not, and you see whether you slow down the epigenetic clock. And those are the two, you know, way, roughly, there are many, many other possibilities, but roughly the two most important. It would be nice if by reading the epigenetic clock or the combination of epigenetic protein and lipids, you could say, oh, the underneath mechanism that is driving this older age in this individual is that there's been some oxygen sensing that is not working properly. And then you could do intervention that are specifically targeted to the oxygen sensing. The possibility are enormous. You know, I think that, remember, I told you before that I think that the part of medicine that is not developed is the treatment of patients with complex multimorbidity. Okay, and I'm very, very eager that we do something about it. But at the same time, we use the same set of biomarkers in clinical application that we used 30 years ago. When I started doing medicine, we were looking at the glucose, cholesterol, you know, the series of CBC and chemicals that have not changed at all in 30 years. Mm-hmm. But we have so much more, and we have so much more that is incredibly predictive and powerful. You know, all those clocks could be integrated. And, you know, with the technology we have now, all of them could be measured in a drop of blood through robotics. And so those 15 minutes that a patient is seen by a doctor, if you could provide to that doctor all that information in a complex, in a very synthetic form, you know, you see this person that has a bruise in the shoulder, but look, there is, you know, a number of other multimorbidities that are hiding under the hood that if you take care now, maybe you can avoid something happening in the future. That's how this technology could be applied seriously to clinical medicine, change the face of clinical medicine forever. And I hope that I'm live enough to see this happen, because I think it will be an enormous transformation. Think about then doing this systematically in everybody, archiving them, and then using artificial intelligence to track what has worked, what does not work, what this biomarker means in terms of the effectiveness of treatment that doctors have used. So those same information can constantly be refined by ourselves and lead to rule and lead to suggestions for intervention that are constantly, you know, progressively more refined. I know this is not science fiction. All of what we need to do this, we have now. We just need the will to do it.
Yeah, so if I understand you correctly, you're saying, you know, we have access to all these more advanced technologies, these tests, but in the clinic, doctors are still using all the old tests from 30 years ago. What do you think is standing in our way? What's the barrier that's preventing this new technology from making its way into the clinic?
I don't know. I think that, you know, it's
a hard question.
It's easy to stay where you are. No, you know, in order to do this, you need another generation of doctors. You know, you will not use the same doctor you have now. You will need doctor that understand the biology of aging. You will need doctor that understand the complex use of biomarkers in the diagnosis and treatment of people with complex disease. It's a transformation that is extremely difficult, and somebody needs to have the will to do it. I think that I'm thinking, and I'm dreaming here. I'm thinking of a big hospital that decide that they're going to lead the pack. And that every patient that they've seen, the Mayo Clinic did it, at the beginning when they did, when they measured DNA on everybody, that every patient that was coming in. I think that we need somebody that is demonstrating that this is not only feasible, but, improve health outcome and also allow you to save enormous amount of money, because if you improve health span, the amount of money you can save is just enormous. And the amount of health that you can produce is equally enormous. I know, I'm sorry, you push me in that direction and I can't really avoid dreaming a little bit.
No, it's great. We want you to dream. We want to hear all about your dreams. And I know you just mentioned bringing all these tests through. Maybe shifting gears, Tim, I know you have some questions about therapeutics.
Yeah, I think you kind of have gotten to this, Dr. Ferrucci, already. Your point on the therapeutics, we've mentioned rapamycin, the Pearl trial, TAME, metformin trial. I mean, essentially, you kind of hit it on the head here. We need people to actually, implement these therapeutics and diagnostics. So I don't know if you had any other, you've also mentioned, senolytics, drugs that kill senescent cells in a lot of the interviews you've done and other places. I don't know if you had any comments on other strategies you wanted to inform our community on that you were excited about. But in general, it seems like, we just are kind of lacking we just need somebody to take the plunge for us to prove out some of these ideas.
Well, if I had a crystal ball and I will tell you what are the two therapeutics that are more likely to really be effective in the future, certainly are senolytics and also the new drug that are coming out for improved mitochondrial function, the urolithin A and the many other compounds that are in the pipeline. And the reason is that, the senolytic is almost magic. I think that, at least when you look at in vitro and in animal model, the elimination of senescent cells seems to work out miracles. And that we understand what is the underlying mechanism, not completely. There is a lot of cloudy, element, we know enough to predict that if what we know will be applicable in humans, it will really change the effect of the new senolytic. And we have only started, using few of them, that I can count the senolytic that have been used in one hand, probably, or maybe in two. So I think that there's a lot of research that needs to be done. For example, in my group, there is one of my collaborators that is working on natural extracts. And I don't want to, diffuse any, but there are herbal this extract that have incredible senolytic and senomorphic activities. And so I think that's a promising direction that we should go to. And I think that will preserve good surprises. The mitochondria, I think that, I love mitochondria, those little organelles. I think that are my passion forever and they still are. And I also think that when we talk about resiliency, Resiliency requires a lot of extra energy. You don't do DNA repair if you don't have a lot of ATP. You don't refold the protein if you don't have a lot of ATP. You don't do mitochondrial biogenesis if you don't have a lot of ATP. So I think that the energy required for resilience is provided by the mitochondria. So they are, if not the first stage of triggering the aging process, they're really necessary to, you know, implementation of resiliency at the biological level. And you know, I think that some of the compounds that have been developed seem to work really well. And the other thing that I think is promising is that the lipid that have been identified in the circulation associated with mitochondrial function seem really to focus on lysophosphatidylcholine at low number of carbons, 18, 18.1, 18.2. And that really suggests that the problem is cardiolipin, and cardiolipin could be a very, very good target for future intervention. So I think the mitochondria and autophagy will give us the best surprises. Who knows?
So just a quick question, just kind of a quick comment here. I think Dr. Ferrucci, you really, in one of your reviews in several places, you've actually, in Aging Cell and others, you've kind of commented on, just for the audience out there, that there's this issue, right, of damage. You know, aging is kind of this damage, and then there's compensation, and kind of ultimately the damage prevails over the compensation. So you're talking about mitochondria being part of the compensation and resiliency to combat damage is a beautiful paradigm that you've put forth. So I encourage everyone to look at some of the writings Dr. Ferrucci has on this topic. It really does a really nice job of explaining it to everyone. So
definitely. Just one quick follow-up question for what we've been saying about therapeutics. There's a lot of emerging interest in reprogramming and partial reprogramming. Do you feel like that has a lot of potential?
Well, I think that's fascinating for sure. I think that the use of the Yamanaka factor, in reprogramming, and I always thought that was science fiction, really. Mm-hmm. But now they seem to be working in the end of a lot of people, and there is an enormous amount of funding that is now dedicated to exploring the possibility. I mean, when I read the paper, the last paper of Daddy Sinclair, I have to say that I reported that to my group, and everybody remained with an O in their mouth. It's just amazing to see, this intervention that with just three molecules was able to reconstitute those neurons and those ganglia and reestablish vision. There are many, people are harsh because they tend to criticize the little detail, of the paper. And certainly, when I talk to people, they come up with the little detail. But this is something that is actually wonderful and marvelous about that idea and that experiment, that I can't really avoid thinking that may have a big future. And in the same paper, the idea of the reprogramming of the methylation, the epigenetic reprogramming, and thinking where the hell is the information that allow you to do back to the epigenetic reprogramming. If you go back with the program, that means that in some place you have that information, and we have absolutely no idea where that information is stored. I think that was another part of that paper that truly they took, it was very, very interesting.
All right, so we've got kind of 1 minute before the hour. We just wanted to maybe give you, Dr. Ferrucci, just a chance to provide some words of advice, maybe to Vita Dow and other kind of nascent communities in this space. And just
if I can spend one word, I wanted to say, enter into the field of aging. do it. When I did it, when I say to people, I want to study aging, people thought that I was crazy. And I never regretted having done it. And in the field, even more ripe now, to great discovery. It's a beautiful place. If you love science, so studying the science of aging is probably going to have the strongest effect on the well-being of our society. And it's a beautiful community of people that love working together. So if I can just say a last word to the young people that hopefully they're listening, come to the aging field. It's fun and it's very, very, very productive. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you.
Those were awesome, awesome final words. Definitely. Thank you so, so much for joining us today. It was lovely having you.
Thank you.
Really appreciate your time. Have a good afternoon.
Bye.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.